Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of Secrets in the City with your host, Dr. Catherine Nisko.
That's me.
All right, on to this episode. Do you guys remember the movie As Good as It Gets? Well, my next guest was forced to answer that question. Her response? Hells no. Chandra Moran, founder of the Transit Lounge, now calls herself a recovered workaholic. After having more than one shut-up-and-think moments, she left her corporate role and made the scary step into uncharted territory, a world where you can wake up happy, you look forward to work, and go to bed fulfilled. I know, sounds impossible. This episode is packed with so much actionable advice that I urge you to grab a pen and paper and take notes. My favorite is her bump into exercise, which will, in a matter of seconds, provide you with a checkup and a check-in to whether or not you're on the right path to a life with purpose. Without further ado, let's hear from the wonderful and wise Chandra. All right, let's kick things off right from the bat. What secret do you select?
Well, there was lots of them that I could have selected, but the one that really jumped out at me was, I feel guilty about being a workaholic.
Why did that one hit home to you?
Because I'm totally a workaholic, although I do like to refer to myself as a recovering workaholic, but I really resonated with that that feeling of guilt and all of the stuff that came with the or comes with, I think, that realization around being so drawn to working. And I think it prompted me to think back about my work history, and I think that's why it really stood out the most to me as something that I think in some ways is a bit of an epidemic. And I think that's also why I think it's a good and important one to talk about.
I think that there is this badge of honor that if you're not exhausted, if you're not busy, then you're not pushing yourself hard enough. Do you relate to that, I guess, in the past?
Kat, I really can. And I think it was an interesting one for me to look back on, because when I was in it, I think at the peak of the worst of it for me, I don't know that I would have recognized that's actually what was going on for me. I just felt like that was normal and that on an upward trajectory professionally, that's what it took. And I was working in a very male-dominated industry, and so I don't know whether that also played into it as well, of just feeling like I had to do more to keep up or to be seen as credible, but definitely just that feeling of never enough. Was true for me, for sure.
Absolutely. Talk to me a bit more about this gender difference, if you will, because what year was this? Like, was this 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? And talk to me about perhaps some of those experiences.
Mm-hmm. So I was working in the radio industry, and even the process of how I got the job was kind of interesting to look back on. So I was, it was about 25 years ago, was when I came back from living in London for a few years. You know, you do the whole traveling, working holiday kind of thing. Came back, thought, okay, I've got to get a job. And I decided I wanted to work in media. And through various introductions and things, I got an interview with a head of sales, I think he was, in a FM radio station. And the interview process was, I thought, quite hilarious. But when I talked to my sister about it, when I went home, she was mortified about some of the things that were spoken about in this interview. And so just for example, halfway through the interview, there was music blaring from the office next door to where we were sitting. And so the guy that was interviewing me just banged on the wall so hard and just said, shut the F up. And I was just sitting there like, okay, is this normal or not? But I sort of like, okay, so we had a laugh. And then some of the other conversations was, you know, he said, this is a really creative hot pot industry and we like it that way. And it's important that you know that when someone finds out what you're sensitive about, that's the thing they're going to give you shit about. if someone knows that you're kind of uncomfortable, they're going to go to that. So just know and know that that's normal, and we kind of encourage it. And also, he said, you know, someone's just as likely to come up to you and say, hey, great set of tits. And you kind of got to be okay with that. And I know saying that now sounds even worse than when I told my sister on the day of the interview. But I don't know why. But for me, I just kind of, I don't know, I laughed. I thought, oh, well, I guess they're being open and honest about this environment, right? And for me, I wasn't necessarily feeling very sensitive about any of that. And it speaks so much now, especially to what things used to be like. And I guess with all the Me Too and the things that are coming out at the moment with the music industry as well, it's sort of interesting that this is coming up now, that I remember thinking and saying to my sister, who was a primary school teacher, so very different environment, I remember saying to her, I said, well, actually, maybe it's good that they're being this open about what it's really like, because imagine if they weren't and someone came into that sort of environment and would be way completely confronted. But I did say to him in the interview, I said, have you ever wondered whether you could be sued for sexual harassment in an interview? And he wow. just kind of laughed oh. about it. Yeah. So, but it's so interesting that I haven't thought about that for a while, but that interview process kind of was the introduction to what the industry was like. And it's not necessarily just about the male dominated thing, but I guess just culturally the environment of what was okay and what was actually seen as culturally normal and expected in terms of social interaction and all of that kind of stuff. I think really as one of my early jobs and careers, that probably informed a lot of that attitude of like of how I had to be in order to not just survive but thrive in that environment, that probably for a lot of people that wouldn't have been okay. I guess I don't know if that even goes anywhere close to answering your question, but it was kind of like that was my early experience of getting into radio.
When you were talking about this whole concept of normality, the one thing that I often question is it normal or is it common? And just because something is common, does that make it normal?
Interesting distinction.
Like as an example of this, when I used to work with women who dislike their bodies, and it's very abnormal for a woman to say, yeah, I think I'm beautiful and I love the way I am. It's very abnormal. So the opposite side of that is, is it normal to just say, oh God, I look so fat, and oh God, I have horrible thighs? No, it is not normal. It is common. Mm. So what do you think about that distinction?
I think that in the context of working and, you know, that the theme of, you know, being a workaholic and the sort of culture that you are in that perhaps encourages that, I think that certainly my experience of working in the media for over 10 years was that it was very common for that to happen.
You just caught
yourself.
Yes,
I did.
You just caught yourself, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, very, very common. And in fact, it was, as you said earlier, that badge of honor that a lot of people talk about, that if you've worked in radio, you can work anywhere else and it will seem like a breeze compared to radio. And that badge of honor was that if you survive radio, then it sets you up that you can go to TV, for example, and that's so much easier. Whereas people that go from a different industry into TV often get freaked out at the enormity of it and the busyness of it, the pace of it. But compared to radio, which is a living, breathing machine that's on 24/7, it was that seen as that badge of honor of setting you up that, you know, if you can hack that, then, you know, you can hack anything. So, you know, maybe that, mm-hmm. again, culturally kind of was that expectation of like, you got to be good enough to make it and to survive and do well. Yeah, that probably influenced.
So it It sounds almost like a rite of passage. And it's interesting. I have two stepdaughters, and one of them applied for a job without us even knowing. The other one is quite different. She's definitely enjoying being a teenager. But this concept of this new generation not actually even considering this rite of passage of hard work, like, what is this hard work? And don't I get to, like, it's very different than I think of our generation, not to compare the two and not to put them into buckets. But do you think nowadays there's, because a lot of companies are just worried about being sued for what they put their juniors through. Like, I'm thinking about law companies, like, you know, you see the movie with John Grisham and, you know, what those legal aides go through, sleeping under their desks. You know, gone are those, are those days gone? Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. And I mean, I'm long out of media. I still have, you know, people that are, you know, part of my circle of friends that are in the industry, and I've done some project work back in the industry. And my observation is that it is very, very different now than what it used to be. And I don't know whether that's a change in corporate culture, and or a change in generational attitude of what people will accept, what they're prepared to provide in exchange for the salary that they receive. But I definitely, you know, my observation just of that industry is that it has changed a lot and become a whole lot less inappropriate in many, many ways, and a whole lot more, you know, about business and, I guess, corporate responsibility and that sort of thing. I'm sure there's still many things that are not perfect, but my observation is that, you know, when I think back to some of the regular events and, you know, end of week staff drinks and things that used to go on, you know, it's not Wolf of Wall Street kind of stuff, but there's some things that are not, that you kind of go, you could never get away with any of that now. Even some of the conversations, like, it's it feels very much like a different world. And so I'm pleased to see that it seems to have evolved a lot. And if that is partly down to generational expectation, then I say all power to them and good on them, because they've created a shift that that in my generation we couldn't or weren't successful at, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. It's a needed shift. And it sort of gets down the rabbit hole of one of the things that you do is help people actually enjoy what they do for their career, but not burn out in the process. And I could imagine that maybe this is a hard concept for a lot of people to adopt, because they're like, oh, if I want to get ahead in my career, don't I have to be fatigued? Don't I have to be like in this bitchy mood because I'm so exhausted all the time? So tell me about some of your, you know, what you do for, you know, with, is it mostly women that you work with?
Yeah, it is. I do have some clients that are males, but in terms of where I kind of really see my sweet spot and where I, you know, position myself is to specialize in working with women who have had a successful career. And generally they've got to some sort of level of leadership roles in their industry. So they're really good at what they do, but they've got to a point that for whatever reason, they've now decided for the next chapter of their work life, they want to start their own thing, their own business. And so for some women, it's their situation is like mine was, which is where so I got out of radio at a point where I was probably what some people would regard as at the height of my success in the industry and, you know, had achieved a lot and won awards and, you know, lots of things that on the surface, you know, are success. But I had this feeling in me that was just deeply unfulfilled, that even for the great ratings results and how fun it was and all the freebies and things that I used to get, I just felt that underlying feeling of, is this it? And what came with that was a bit of an identity crisis, which we can talk about later if you want to, but it led me to decide to not re-sign a contract. And people kind of fell into two camps when I made that decision. One were, you know, 50% of people thought, good on you, because so many people say they're going to quit their job and do something else and never do it. So good on you. And the other 50% were like, are you mental? You are living the dream. How dare you throw that all away? That kind of attitude. It was very interesting to see how different people responded to that. My first midlife crisis is what I call that one.
No, it's spiritual awakening.
Oh, great. I've got it.
Not midlife crisis. Spiritual awakening.
Okay. My first spiritual awakening was that. I trained as a coach at a time when no one really understood what coaching was, and did a few meandering streams. And then I ended up working with an awesome learning and development company and loved that job. And I thought, this is it. I'm never going to have to change jobs again. I've found my mecca and all of that. That didn't go to plan. And I kept getting sick all the time and was eventually diagnosed with severe adrenal fatigue. And
Can we stop there?
Sure.
And can you tell me a bit more about this like shitstorm that you went through? Let's just be honest.
Okay. So this new company that I loved, I loved the people, I loved what it stood for, all of that. It, to its credit, continued to grow. And so my role continued to grow. And because I loved it so much, I just kept working more and more and more. The projects kept getting bigger and bigger. And then eventually, like, I really pushed myself. Like, it was ridiculous. When I think back on it now, I'm lucky that I'm still married. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. All these threads we can talk about, okay? It got to a point where it was like, actually, I really need to look at this, because I kept getting sick all the time. Eventually went and got tested and was diagnosed with sort of severe adrenal fatigue. And that was a real shut up, think and feel moment for me, because I was so conflicted that I loved this job, I loved the organization, but there was a new CEO that had come in that I did not feel a values alignment with at all. I could see the direction of the company was going down a path where my role had moved so far away from what I had originally thought it was going to be, way away from people development side of things and much more, you know, administrative, financial, operational, that kind of thing. But I believed in this company so much that I stayed and I kept pushing myself and I kept telling myself, if I can just do this, if we can just get through this project, or, oh, it's just this client that's particularly high maintenance. I kept giving myself those stories. And then it just kind of got to the point I remember, you know, moments, one in particular where I was driving to work. And for context, I'm not a crier. In fact, a badge of honor that I had for a very long time was that I don't cry, because that's tough, right? That's cool, like strong, can handle anything, don't cry. I remember driving to work and starting to cry just about the thought of what was ahead for me that day and the fatigue of not really getting over whatever the previous day's shit fight had been. And I had to pull over because I was crying so much that part of me was like, not safe, need to stop driving now. And that was a moment where I kind of thought, oh, okay, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. We're kind of in an uncharted territory about what you're pushing yourself to do. And it just opened up, you know, a whole lot of conversations and thoughts about, well, what do I do? I thought this was it, and I thought I was good enough and I could hack this and all of that. And then there was a big part of me that was like, is this actually how you want to live your life? And fortunately for me, for a number of reasons, there was enough connection that I had with myself about what was important to me that I was able to make that decision to leave that job, as hard as that was, from both an identity perspective and also a financial perspective of what does that mean to go from this very healthy, lovely, regular salary coming in every month to my own thing, and like, where's the money going to come from? And I've got four mortgages or whatever it was at that time, and how do we, you know, maintain this lifestyle? And but fortunately for me, I was able to make that decision and to do the things that I needed to do to, I guess, come back from burnout And it was through my experience of doing that that really led me to be super passionate about working with more women who perhaps find themselves in a situation, whether it's a health reason or a lifestyle reason, where they're looking at the trajectory of where their career is taking them and going, shit, man, I don't want that anymore. And how do I help them, you know, work out what they do want to do and to make that transition to create a life where they can still love what they do. I think that's the workaholic in me speaking, because it's important, I think, that you love what you do. If you spend a lot of time working, that you love it, to earn enough money to feel the sense of freedom of choices of that you want and to create the lifestyle that you want and not kill yourself through burning out on the way. And so that opened up a whole line of different things that I've done since then. But that's how I got where I am now.
I love that. It sounds like your current career is based on your heart a lot. Well, not more than your head, but there's so much passion in that. And one of the things, I mean, I got so many nuggets of wisdom out of that. I was like, I wish I had a notepad. But one thing is let go of certainty, because the opposite is an uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women think, I have to stay in this job because it's secure. Mm-hmm. I have kids to feed. I have a mortgage to pay. And I think so many people, especially women, are going to be listening to this and saying, oh my God, that's me. So what would you say to these people who are listening saying, I so relate to that story, but I don't know what to do?
Yeah, it is true that there, for a lot of women, certainly that I speak to, that is one of their first hurdles. Let's say that for whatever reason, they get to that point, they allow themselves to think, oh shit, maybe I need to make a change. One of the very first handbrakes that comes up is the financial one. How do I handle that? And it's real. And I definitely do not go to the school of thought of, you know, ripple off like a band-aid, you'll be fine, just back yourself. I don't think that's a smart way to go. And there is a lot of, even beyond the financial, there's a lot of things that are uncertain. And in fact, I had a conversation with someone who's in exactly that position. She's got a great job, but she wants to do her own thing. And she's been flapping around, in her own words, for ages, not making the moves. And part of it is around, how am I going to see if this is viable and how will I replace that salary? And I think some of the things that are really important that I would suggest that people do at that stage is to start to really get clear about your values. What is it that is actually most important to you in the context of your work life, or in the context of your whole life, what you want to experience, of which work is a part? And then start to look at the ways, if you've got an idea for your business, working out what are some of the first steps that I could take just to test this idea. So don't quit the job and hope that this idea is going to work. There's foundational things and little market research and testing or prototyping that you can do to give you evidence, and that evidence can help give you confidence. And I think one of the things, and I was having this conversation with my group this morning about that lack of self-confidence in going into their own thing. And I think that for a lot of us, we want to feel confident before we take the action. But in my observation, confidence comes after the action, and it does take you being a little bit brave. And the first action is not quit my job. The first action might be deciding, I want to go this direction. How do I do that? And starting to do some research, starting to connect with, you know, different resources. There's so many resources out there that can be helpful. Being willing to just take small steps gives you evidence of how does this feel. And when you test something, it might be, well, that's not quite it, but what about this? Or having a conversation with someone that you trust about the idea to give you information that's feedback that you can then go, oh, what else do I need to know? And taking those baby steps, so important in that early phase. And also when you're looking for certainty, I'm unfortunately going to burst a bubble for a few people, that going into your own business and feeling the master of your own domain does not mean that uncertainty goes away. There's certainly some things that are fantastic about it, but you're almost always stretching out of your comfort zone. And so that feeling of discomfort and uncertainty is always going to be there. So you've got to make friends with it to a certain extent, and to be looking at your situation and going, I've got myself here, which is amazing. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're a woman that has created success in your career, you are amazing. You've done a lot of things to get there. The one thing that you can have certainty in is yourself, your ability to learn anything that you decide that you want to learn or need to learn that's going to serve you on the path that you want to go down. And that certainty is far better than any external certainty of a supposed secure salary or a safe industry or any of that. So anything you can do to remind yourself of certainty in yourself, I think, is the biggest gift that you can give yourself and would serve you so well through making that transition and beyond, I think. And again, I think I've gone on a meandering stream, not sure if I even really answered your question.
I was nodding my head for the audience. I'm sitting here like my neck is starting to hurt because so much of what you say is what I teach. Like this whole concept of taking action first. For me, confidence is actually about taking action and not necessarily knowing what the result is going to be. Now, this isn't jumping out of a plane without a parachute. It's planned, practiced action, but mm-hmm. it's actually taking action. And that's how the bricklaying of skills and confidence grows. And so, like, we are definitely singing from the same hymn book in that sense.
Awesome.
But the question is, if a person is in a job and perhaps maybe they're in a job that's dragging them down, they're fatigued, maybe their self-esteem or self-worth is low, how do you get outside of yourself? Like, how do you, you know, you can't read the label if you're inside the bottle. How do you look at yourself and say, it's okay, take that first step? I guess this is where coaching and mentoring really plays a massive part.
It does. And it certainly was for me, because when I got to that point, so I had the diagnosis, it prompted me and Mick, my beautiful husband, to go to Bali for a one-week wellness escape. And I sat on the beach and I remember writing my 5-point wellness plan with a bonus 6th point of what I was going to do to help myself get better. And I took it back to my naturopath. I was so excited about it. And I said, my 5-point wellness plan. And she said, there's 6 points on here. Do you have to over deliver on everything? It was like, oh, actually, that's a good point. But for me, like, it really was me looking at what tangibly could I do without changing everything? What are some of the things? And for me, some of them were on the work front around delegating, trying to carve out and set up a designated end point to my day, because I was terrible at finishing work at a certain reasonable time. And so I wanted to experiment with kind of saying, no, I finish work at 6 o'clock or whatever time it was. So there were some practical things like that. But I also started working with a coach because I wanted that external perspective to be able to help me create a plan and also to see the potential of what I could do. I had ideas of what I potentially could do, but I didn't know all of the steps. And so for me, working with a coach at that time was very beneficial. Now, for some people, that may not be an option for them, and whether it is or it isn't, an activity that I really suggest that is really beneficial is for you to sit down and think about your career and think about maybe 3 or 4 career highlights in your mind. So moments in your work life where you have felt particularly proud of a result or a project or an achievement, and to be writing down, you know, what happened, what was that event, who was there, and what did you do, to remind yourself, to immerse into that experience, and then to extract out and go, okay, what skills or characteristics did I demonstrate and use well in order to achieve that result? And you'll kind of write that down. And often what happens is once you get going, so you think of the examples first and then, you know, extend them out, you'll start to notice either some common themes in characteristics or types of scenarios that where you really felt like you were thriving. And you start to also remember how good you are and the things that you have done and achieved and what you've contributed to through that work context. So that's a practical activity that I think when people have just lost sight of who they really are and what they're capable of, can be a great way to have some tangible reflections of actually, you know, the skills and characteristics that they've got that are super valuable and will serve them, you know, going forward.
When I was listening to that, I was thinking, oh, wouldn't it have been so good to have you as a coach 10 years ago? And I was thinking, I can actually do that exercise now, like, because I guess the journey of career growth never, ever stops. Mm. So even right now, I mean, Melinda and I, we have a mutual friend for the audience listening. We're constantly thinking about, like, how can we create a life that we really want to live? How can we create more perfect days? And that's what we're doing now. And we get along really well. And obviously our other team members, Gabby, also known as Gab, we're trying to create this life that we can't wait to wake up in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I think that's beneficial for the people listening, is if you are in that career that's floating your boat, how can you raise the bar even more?
Yeah. And I think that part of what that prompts for me is a willingness to think about the wholeness of the life that you want to create, and that there are parts of it that are beyond work. And I think for me, for so long, I had an identity of myself that was completely entangled with what I did professionally, and that when I started thinking about leaving my job with Nova, one of the first things that came up for me was like, well, hang on, if I don't have Nova as part of my label of who I am, who am I and what do I actually do? And I'd immersed so much of my focus of my life into work and having the ability to, I guess, say that that's where I worked and the job that I had that I attributed so much value to. And I think that when I started unraveling that and realizing, well, what else is in my life in terms of hobbies or things that I did socially, everything was so linked to the job. And so I think that when I think back to me at that stage, and maybe for women listening who might feel they're at that point, to be willing to dream a little bit about the wholeness of life beyond just the work lens, and to see that there's great merit in other aspects of life being thriving as well. Because I think that was definitely something that I struggled with. I think I'd carved out this focus of being a worker that even if I started to look outside my life of work, there wasn't very much there because I was working all the time. And I think it became a bit of a vicious cycle that if I didn't have much going on socially outside of work, all my closest friends were work friends, it was very siloed, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so it was a stretch for me. I remember my naturopath, actually, you know, fast forwarding, you know, asking me, she said, what are you doing outside of work? Like, as a hobby. And I was like, what's a hobby? Like, who has time for a hobby? And then of course I, you know, came up with a whole business idea of a website that helped workaholics do a profile to match a hobby that would be perfect for them. Like, why are you trying to turn everything into a business idea or something? Why can't you just do something just for fun? I don't know. My brain is weird, wired differently. But definitely I think starting to think about what kind of future life am I creating through the action that I'm taking today is something that really I latched onto. And I at first I had to really make effort to think about it and allow my brain to go there because it didn't naturally seem to want to go there. And, you know, an activity that I think is a great one to explore that is to just ask yourself, what would I like to do or experience one day? And it's inspired from the book, The One Thing, which is a brilliant book on many levels. But for me, that particular question allowed me to remove the concerns about how I was going to make something happen or fit it into my busy life the use of the one day just allowed me to go into that dreaming space and to see what popped up. And then, you know, since doing that, of being able to then work backwards and go, well, how is what I'm doing now heading me in that direction or setting me up to make that more likely to happen? And I found that quite good as a way of sort of linking what I'm doing now to what I actually want my future self to experience.
Oh gosh, we are definitely on the same page. We have a saying within our team, what would Oprah do? Okay. Because one of my goals, you know, I have a screensaver of Oprah introducing me on stage that Gabby has like superimposed. So it looks like she's actually introducing me. And we have all these things that one thing and the perfect day and how can we visualize it? And one of Einstein's great quotes is saying, imagination is a preview for life's most incredible attractions. Oh. And so allowing yourself, especially when I walk the dogs, my mind is constantly somewhere else and just imagining it. But I have to say that this was a process because if you don't think you're worthy of achieving that goal, you can imagine everything you want out the wazoo, but you don't actually really believe it. And I think imagination has to have that core. I actually truly believe that not only am I going to achieve this goal, but I deserve to believe this goal or to achieve this goal. So I think, do you find that a lot with perhaps women? Because you are working with, I presume, you know, if they are well ahead in their career, do they still have self-worth issues?
Totally. And you know, I love that distinction. I'm going to adopt that for myself about adding the question about the believability attached to the one day activity. In terms of self-belief, totally. Because what tends to come up is for a lot of women, not everybody, but I think a lot of them, is the story that, well, I'm good as an employee and I can do a good job in this environment or in this role. But when it comes to doing my own thing, have I really got what it takes? You know, and you know, what will other people think about what I'm doing? Is it going to work? How long is it going to take? And is it better for me to just, you know, keep sucking it up and doing this until I retire and then maybe I'll dabble in it? So there's a lot of that question of, you know, can I really do this? And the way I see it play out, and it's interesting because I have a group that I do coaching and implementation group called Women in Transit, and one of the members is still working in a career, and she's got two business ideas that she's developing. But you know, she was sharing with us this morning. It was a Q&A coaching session, and she's been observing that, you know, she's got questions that keep holding her back that are pure mindset, and it's attached to, you know, listening more to what other people say than listening to herself, and also that question of, you know, can I really do this, and, you know, not knowing how to do it and not feeling confident in what it looks like yet, and then therefore that, which loops back to that thing about confidence, and so it holds her back from, you know, making decisions like just deciding on a business name. And she's been looping this. And so I've been, you know, ginger ninja tough loving her a little bit and encouraging her to make this first, because it's another milestone decision of when you kind of go, this is what my business is called. Because when you do that, you're kind of really declaring to yourself and to others, I am becoming a business owner and my business is called this thing. And so definitely it's a great conversation. And the others that are in the group also were able to share their experiences of tackling that self-belief voice and how they'd experienced it and the things that they did to self-regulate or manage that and keep moving forward. So I think it's definitely something that is common. And so if you notice that coming up, then, you know, first thing is like realizing, oh, I think I've got a gap in confidence, and then exploring, right, what's that first small action that I might need to take to help me, you know, get some feedback from myself or from the market, or to get some confidence of going, oh, that actually, I did that one thing and I didn't die. Hey, maybe I'll take the next step. You know?
Absolutely. I think sometimes you need to surround yourself with people that can call you out on your own bullshit, mm-hmm. because I think we become very good lawyers because we are so firmly in a relationship with our limiting beliefs. It's kind of like the way I describe it, especially from a neural point of view, is imagine if all your life you were writing with your left hand. So for, 30, 40, 50 years. And then there's this opportunity, the living your life in a different way, living your life where you're not exhausted all the time, but you have to learn how to write with your right hand. So maybe one day you're feeling good and you start writing with your right hand, but then something comes out of left field, something stresses you out, and you don't even realize you start writing with your left hand again. Yeah. And this is the equivalent of saying, I'm not good enough, I'm not worth it, this is never going to happen. And you're like, damn it, that's my old self again. And then you have to force yourself to write with the right hand again. And it's from a neural point of view, you can't change overnight. And it's people that recognize in what we spoke about before is this frustration, making errors is actually the key from an evidence-based point of view is a key to confidence. Mm-hmm. You're not going to feel confident while you're trying to become more confident. Yes. That's the paradox of building confidence. And that's why a lot of people rely on external validation, or I'm just going to lose weight. And when I do, then I'll feel confident, or I'll just get this raise. I'll just get this higher level job and then I'll feel confident. And it's like this never ending chasing carrot. I'm like, just sit the F down, eat the carrot and move on. Like, do things differently. You can't do the same thing. There's a scene in Seinfeld. I don't know if you've ever watched this episode where George Costanza does everything opposite to what he usually does. And, he's a bit of a dag and like he's always, losing jobs and not sticking in relationships. He lives with his parents. And this one time in the diner, he just goes up to a woman and says, listen, I don't have a job. I live with my parents. I'm short, I'm fat, I'm bald. And she says, oh, my name is Sonia. Nice to meet you. So for the people listening, go out there and do the exact opposite of what you normally do.
I love it. I love it. And I really love the right and left hand analogy, because I think it's a really practical thing that people can understand. Because sometimes when it comes to talking about how our brains work, we can tell ourselves it's all very confusing. But I love, that example, because I think people can relate to it. And it prompts for me that feeling again of discomfort or unfamiliarity of starting to write with the other hand. And that when you're starting to go from a career into starting your own thing, or for some other people, it might not be starting their own business. It might be going into a different industry or whatever significant change they're making, start to realize that when things are feeling unfamiliar, there's going to be a sense of discomfort in that, but feel excited about it because it means that you are learning something new. And no matter how uncomfortable it is, the next time you do it, it won't feel anywhere near as uncomfortable because it's more familiar than it was the first time you did it. And I think it's that reframing of what it means when something doesn't feel good or feel familiar, because especially when you're trying to create change and something different, of how do you, and knowing it's that whole thing of everything you need to grow is outside of your comfort zone, that what you're making it mean when something feels uncomfortable. For me, one of the things I remember realizing when I left radio and was training as a coach, They asked a really great question, which was something about, what's going to be something that's going to be difficult for you in making this transition. And I remember writing down that it was going to be difficult for me to go from essentially being at the top of my game, knowing all the answers. And if anybody had a question about, a marketing promotion that we were doing or on-air strategy or talent manager, I knew the answer. I was just used to, knowing all the stuff that I needed to know, to going into a whole new industry where I was kind of back in the learning mode again, where I didn't necessarily have all the answers, that was going to feel really challenging for me as someone that had always attached to, my success in my work as coming from my confidence in what I was doing and how I was doing it. So I think just knowing this, it's the looping cycles of getting back into the learner seat is going to feel weird, especially when you're going into something, you know, brand new.
Yeah, it's kind of getting back into that beginner's mindset where you need to make frustration your friend and you need to expect errors.
Yeah,
I think is a good way to look at it. Now, when it comes to frustration, you sort of alluded to this earlier on, is when you were going through your transit period, there was perhaps you insinuated some sort of bumpy times with your now husband. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it was really leading up to so I had the diagnosis. We went away to Bali, came back, and I was like, okay, I'm going to have a set end time to my day. I also spoke to the company about my health situation and agreed to drop down to 4 days a week, and that was a disaster for very many reasons. They just jammed my full-time role into 4 days and just paid me less, so that was not good. In fact, they moved meetings that used to happen on the day that they told me I had to have off, which was a Tuesday. They said that was the best day for me to have off. And they moved meetings from the Tuesday to the other days because they really wanted me there. So I was like, this is not really working. Anyway, I was still just pushing myself. And there's this one event that I think was pivotal for me that is really uncomfortable for me to remember, but so important, because Mick, my husband, is an incredibly lovely, patient, generous man, very supportive, and he does not understand why I love working so much. He does a lot of the heavy lifting, if you like, on the home front with cooking. He's a chef by trade. And there was this one particular night I was working on something and he rang and said, okay, are you still at work? It was probably about 7 o'clock. He said, are you still at work? And I said, yeah, sorry, I'm just trying to finish this thing. I'm going to be, you know, leaving really soon. And he's like, okay, well, you know, cool, I'll wait. And then I kept working. I was doing something, and then some other disaster email popped in or whatever, and I was like, oh, just quickly do that. And he sent me a text message at, let's just say, 7:30. It was at least half an hour later. He said, have you left yet? And I looked at the message and I thought, oh shit, I've really got to go, but I just want to quickly finish this. And so I kept working on that thing, and then I don't know, time just went, and there was another text message, I looked at it and I thought, okay, I'm definitely finishing now. And I sort of started packing up, and I don't know, it took the whole thing. And then when I got in the car, I rang Mick to say I'm leaving, and it would have been over an hour from his first message. And he was so angry with me, but in that kind of quiet, upset way that broke my heart. And because he said, you didn't reply to either of my messages. I didn't know if you were dead in a ditch somewhere or what was going on. And now you're calling me and you're still at work. This is not okay. To words to that effect. And I remember driving and feeling like literally just feeling my heart sink, because I just couldn't believe that I'd been so disrespectful to him in just not communicating with him, that I was so focused and in the zone of prioritizing work emails or documents or whatever the hell I was working on, that I couldn't either just take 2 minutes to respond. Even if I did say, you know, I've been delayed, I just was so fixated. And it was a pivotal moment, because I realized that I was kidding myself around what I had told myself was most important to me, where, you know, I would have told myself that my core relationships with Mick and my family were most important to me, but my behaviors, my actions were the total opposite. And it was a come to Jesus moment for me of having to decide, am I going to accept that I am wired to make work the most important thing and that's fulfilling for me and I'm okay with that? Or do I have to seriously change my behavior to actually live in line with my values? And it was a real moment for me of like, all right, I think we've hit that moment and something's got to really change. And it was always after that that I resigned and started my own business.
It reminds me of the four D's, you know, people wait until, I believe it's death, divorce, disaster, and now I can't remember the other one. But we wait until one of those four D's happen to actually make the change. And it sounds to me that, you know, I don't know, like, what was your relationship up to that point? Like, was it close, or was it just, were you just sort of hanging on by a thread, or were you pretending? You know, can you describe to the audience about that? Because they might relate with some of those signs and symptoms and say, oh, wow, that's me. That's us.
Yeah, I think I was very fortunate in my partner and who he is as a person and as a man, in that he's very supportive. But I don't think that we were, you know, on the brink, but I do remember a really close friend of mine saying to me, she had been through a divorce previously and was in a new relationship. And I remember her saying to me at one point, she said, "No one I have ever met works as hard as you do." And I remember thinking, that's an odd thing to say. Lots of people work hard. I remember kind of being quite surprised by that, because, you know, she has a big important job. And then in a separate conversation, she was asking about how Mick was coping with how much I was working. And I realized it hadn't even occurred to me to be thinking about that. And she said, and this obviously, you know, links to her experience. She said something along the lines of, the sense of it was, be careful about that, because men don't cope as well when, you know, their partner's not around. And it was really interesting, because her experience was, you know, a cheating scenario. And so her view of the situation was that there was a high degree of risk of that happening because I was so absent. And again, it had never occurred to me that that might happen. And I don't think, again, that we were at that point, but it was another one of those kind of, you know, drops in the bucket of making me think, maybe I need to think this through differently, because am I taking things for granted that actually I shouldn't? And that if I truly value this relationship, this man, and I want a future that has him and I in it, then how am I nurturing that now? Or am I actually, I'm nurturing a job that's building somebody else's career or financial success in growing their business? And is that really what I want? And so I think all of those things just started to be little clues that prompted me to start to think, maybe the premise that I've been running with, that me having this successful job and bringing in good money, because I earned more than he did, and so there was a sense of responsibility of, you know, contributing to the family funds, if you like. If I'm not, that's part of my responsibility, right? Like, you know, so therefore he should be happy that I'm working because of that, which I think is actually often quite a masculine way of thinking. But those moments of feedback, that event, that, you know, whatever Wednesday night it was, contributed me to me really thinking, hey, I need to make different choices.
That would have been hard, don't you think? I mean, I guess, don't you think? Obviously you do think and you know, but I'm sort of putting myself in your position, because you had to step away, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just putting myself in your position. You would have had to step away from something that you thought you loved or did love, which is, you know, your identity, your worth was wrapped up in this persona of working late, always doing that one more email, like, you know, just one more, one more, one more. And having to sort of step away from that, not knowing what could be on the other side. And it also made me think, like, do we often think that we're going to put a 30% effort into our relationship, but expect a 100% result? Is like, it shouldn't relationships just happen? So that's what I got out of that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it is confronting to look at what your behavior reflects as what you value most, and to then ask yourself, is that actually what I want to be known for? Is it the experience I want to have? Is that the kind of relationship that I want to have? And also, you know, some really uncomfortable realizations around my expectations of, well, if I've worked late, I want to come home and expect that he's got dinner organized. And again, it's that that's traditionally not necessarily what happens in relationships or households. But that was also really uncomfortable for me to realize that frustration. If I walk in the door and I'm late, I've had a busy day, and what do you mean you haven't started dinner? I realize now, looking back, like how rude, how that presumption. But you know, that was, I guess, part of what story I had told myself. This is part of the deal. And I know for some relationships, perhaps that is the deal, but we had never spoken about that. We hadn't kind of, as a partnership, said, you know, this is going to sometimes happen, and are you okay with this, or how do we handle that? And again, for me, I had to ask myself, do I want to be that kind of person? And is that bringing a sense of arrogance or expectation that I don't want as part of who I am? So, you know, definitely that the moment of having conversations and the decision of I'm actually going to resign from this job that has been such a big part of my life for years, and I'm going to start my own thing from scratch and hope that it works, is a combination, I think, of exciting and terrifying. And I do see that in a lot of the women that come into my community and the clients that I work with, of they're exhilarated by the sense of potential and the sense of empowerment of doing their own thing. And there's a massive chunk of concern about, whoa, this is really different, and can I really do this, and what else changes? And there's a whole layer for some of them where if they don't have a supportive partner or family dynamic or friends around them, that can be even harder, because they've got people around them actively saying, no, just ride it out, you'll be fine, why would you give up such a great career, you're mad to do this, and that's not helpful necessarily. So there's a whole world of things that come with just processing internally what's, you know, that inner voice that's screaming at you to just stay with what's known, even though it's killing you. And then you've got, you know, some external voices that are going to be saying the same, you know, stay where you are. And I think it just, everyone, you know, maybe it is the 4Ds, everyone's, you know, trigger moment might be slightly different, but generally there's something that's a catalyst to make you go down that path. For me, it was the health thing, because I remember when I, you know, they did the test results and said, you know, your adrenals are basically flatlined, your body's at kaput, and if you don't change it, you're going to be in all kinds of problems. I actually remember that amongst everything, I felt the greatest sense of relief, and I was glad. And I realized, but I didn't realize this for some time afterwards, I realized that my relief was I had now permission that it was okay for me to quit this job, because without the label of being able to say I'm, you know, I've got health issues, me just deciding for me, that was not enough, obviously, for me to actually make that decision. And when I realized that, and it was, you know, a couple of years after I had left, I sort of looked back and I thought, well, I was unhappy in that job for quite a long time before I actually left. There was another moment, which is probably going to sound super weird, which I don't think I've ever talked about out loud, is that for one stage, Mick and I were looking at buying a property in Bali. And we went, because we used to go fairly regularly, and we went particularly for a trip to go and look at. We'd lined up a real estate agent that was, you know, taking us around to see all these different properties. And I was so excited about this, you know, potential purchase. And then through various reasons and research and everything else, we made the decision that we weren't going to do that. And I remember coming back from that trip and I was feeling, you know, quite upset that it wasn't going to happen. But on reflection years later, I realized that part of my disappointment was that in my head, if we bought a property in Bali, then I would quit my job because we were going to move there. And when that didn't happen, my permission slip to leave the job went away. And so this theme of needing permission or external circumstances to make it okay for me to decide to stop working so much was something that, you know, obviously had played out, that I couldn't just kind of go, you know what, this is shit and I'm killing myself and I don't want to do it anymore. You know?
Absolutely. It kind of reminds me of monkeys swinging through branches. It's like you needed this other branch before you let go of this branch that was withering and disintegrating and killing you. It's like, why not just go on the ground and figure it out? Everything is figure outable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. So maybe if we could, I've learned so much and I'm like, my mind is spinning on how I can apply all these things that you're speaking about. The thing that really resonated with me is, you know, how can we picture or how can we do a litmus test and say, is what we're doing now going to contribute to what we want for our future? That was one thing that I definitely got out. And I think regardless of what stage you are in your life, you can apply that to your relationship, your career, your health, everything. Think about the future. But what are some ways, obviously we'll put in the bio on how to get in touch with you, because I think this whole concept of getting out of your own head, especially with someone who's already done it, who's walked the walk and talked the talk and sort of experienced this, especially post-COVID, I think a lot of people are saying, do I really actually want to stay in my position or do I want to step abroad? Like, what are some of the things that we can think about more, you know, while we're walking the dogs or having a shower, to help us guide ourselves into this, I think, to label it as a better life?
Well, one of the activities that I get my clients to do when we do annual goal planning for them, for their business, is it's a future pace activity where you would go forward in your mind's eye and say it's 3 years or 5 years, choose at least 3 years, but whatever number of years ahead, and that you are walking down the street and you bumped into your future self. And what you want to write down or ruminate, if you're walking and just imagine, you know, this in your head, your future self is telling you about what they're doing now and all the great things that they've done since they were you. And it can feel a bit weird, but it can be really interesting. And to just describe, how does the future you look? How does she sound? What's she wearing? What is she telling you about how you spend your time and where you live and where you work and who you hang out with and where you go for holidays? Let that future you tell you what they've been up to and allow that to be that part of that future dreaming. And it can be really interesting to see what comes up in that kind of imaginary conversation, and then to loop it back and kind of go, all right, well, if that's sort of the direction I want to go, how is what I'm doing now supporting that? Or what's one thing that I could start, experiment with, explore, research, that is more in line with the direction that I want to go? Because it's very unlikely that people will make the change in a single bound, but you can start to do some of the foundational things, you know, particularly around your work. Like for me, one of my goals was that I always wanted to create a business that was allowed me to be what I call geo-flexible, where I could be located anywhere and still be able to connect with my clients and deliver value and do what I do for work. But I didn't have to sacrifice my location in order for that to happen. And so that then informs the kind of business that I have created, which would be different if my one day, someday was actually about having a physical space that people came to. And so that's one of the examples of how you really exploring what you want to have as your future reality, and therefore how it will inform what you prioritize now, what you focus on, what you let go of, what you start. So that's a good kind of practical activity that I think can be good to help start making decisions from where you want to end up, not base decisions on where you are now.
Oh my God, that is absolutely brilliant. We do a similar exercise within our Activate program is, you know, picture your future day, but I love a future perfect day, but I love the seeing yourself bumping your bumping into yourself. And I'm definitely seeing myself in very high heels. And I would just have come out of a meeting with Oprah Winfrey. Yes. And we were discussing how we can better help girls around the world to secure their education. And then I would be going off to a stage and giving a talk for, you know, 100,000 people. Like, I was already in it.
Great. Yeah.
So I would love to put out that challenge to our listeners and picture yourself in 3, 4, 5 years. You know, what are you wearing? What are you seeing? What have you just come from? Where are you going? And, you know, think big. I think don't, you know, break through that invisible glass ceiling and think about the things that you don't think are possible, because I think that's where the challenge really comes. And I love challenge.
Yeah. Awesome.
And lastly, how can people get in touch with you? Because you just sound like, I can't even describe how magical you are. Just the energy that's coming through the microphone. How can people get in touch and work with you?
Yeah, well, you can certainly go to my website, which is thetransitlounge.com. And there's, you know, some free resources there, particularly for women that are at that point of sort of in the early stages of starting their own business. But also I, you know, have a private Facebook group for women that are at that point of thinking about starting their own thing, in order to connect and be, I guess, with a community of other women that are also wanting the same pathway. Because that's really important, that you connect with, you know, a tribe of people that are, you know, aspiring towards similar things to you. Some might be further down the road, and that can just help you to see what's possible. So that Facebook group is called Career Change, Start and Grow Your Own Business. And I'm also on LinkedIn, and I'm super happy to have, you know, quick chats or send me an email, any questions that you've got. I've got podcasts with 130 something episodes, a lot of which are interviews with women who made career change to start their own business after the age of 40. So there's a few ways people can connect with me, but just say hello.
Wonderful. Well, we will make sure to put all those links into the caption or the bio or anything. I know, I hope you don't mind that I'm going to be joining that group on Facebook for sure, because I want to put myself in different echo chambers. Mm-hmm. I want to hear it. I want to be inspired and motivated by those people. And that is exactly what you've done in this episode. I think this is the episode that has given us the most actionable advice ever. So I thank you for your time and energy and passion. And I can't wait to see your journey as it unfolds.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me to be on. And I hope that at some point we'll be able to meet up in person when I next come to Perth, maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Get ready for a massive bone crushing hug.
I'll look forward to it.
Thanks so much. Thank you. I hope you loved every bit of that podcast as much as I did. And like me, we'll put those nuggets of wisdom into practice. And if you want to connect with Chandra so you can earn great money and do the work you love without burning out, you can connect with her on Instagram at The Transit Lounge. We'll, of course, also post all of the other links in the caption below. Lastly, many of you have graciously asked how you can support the podcast. The best way is to first subscribe, and secondly, share with a friend or family member that you believe might benefit from the information. It really is a terrific way to digitally show that you care, and from my heart to yours, I really appreciate it. Thanks again for your time and interest in the Secrets in the City podcast. Until next time, never forget that every day is your chance to shine.